Today, the latest economic ins and outs. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Cash ban apart, there was also a swathe of economic news today, both locally and internationally. And I'm just going to cover off a few of the main points. So firstly, Federal Treasurer Frydenberg released the budget outcome for the 2018-19 financial year. And guess what? We didn't quite go into credit, but broadly, the budget was in balance in 2018-19 with a deficit of $0.7 billion, which represents almost nothing of GDP. And that's an improvement on the deficit of $10.1 billion from last year. The last time the budget was in surplus or in balance was in 2007-8, prior to the impact of the GFC. So you wonder how far those parallels go. And the 2018-19 result was actually an upside surprise, which exceeded the May 2018 budget forecast, which was at $14.5 billion, as well as the revised April 2019 budget forecast of minus $4.2 billion. The result is due to the combination of higher revenues, boosted by commodity prices, particularly iron ore, and lower payments, particularly things like the NDS. And the net operating balance was a surplus of $8.7 billion, or 0.4% of GDP. The net general government debt at June 2019 was $374 billion, or 19.2% of GDP, and that is some $12.5 billion higher than the forecast in the April 2019 budget. So, you know, let's not get carried away. We still have a very significant amount of debt, although that debt to GDP number is relatively small on an international basis. And in keeping with tradition, no figures or commentary were provided for the current financial year and beyond. The mid-year economic and fiscal update for 2019-20 will likely be released by late December. Now, what can we draw from the information that is made available today? Well, firstly, we have a larger economy than anticipated. Nominal GDP growth was 5.3% rather than the 5% anticipated in the April 2019 budget. And the main reason why there was this upside was commodity prices, as we've discussed before, particularly iron ore. And employment grew by 2.6% in the year to the June quarter 2019, which exceeded the budget forecast of 2%. And real GDP grew by 1.9% in 2018-19, falling short of the budget forecast of 2.25%. But that was more than offset by the boom to national income from higher commodity prices. Receipts were up, therefore, and payments were down because total receipts were $485.3 billion, which is $11.5 billion higher than forecast in the May budget, although only $0.1 billion higher than forecast in the April 2019 budget. And receipts as a share of the economy lifted to 24.9% of GDP, up from 24.2% in 2017-18. That is well up from the low of 21.3% back in 2010-11, to be back in line with the rate in 2007-8. Again, a little bit of a scary resonance, which was 25%. And total cash payments in 2018-19 were $478.1 billion, which is some $6.6 billion lower than estimated in the May 2018 budget and $4.6 billion lower than in the April 2019 budget. And payments represented 24.6% of GDP, down from the high of about 25.5% for the 3 years 2013, 2014, to 2015-16. The budget outcome document, which compares outcomes with the May 2018 budget, indicate that the areas of underspend included the NDIS, the Disability Care Australia Fund, and GST payments to the states. So you could certainly argue that the result has been somewhat engineered by controlling spending whilst taking advantage of the Seagull payments thanks to higher iron ore prices. That doesn't necessarily bode well for the future. Now, also today, we had the unemployment data, and Australia's trend unemployment rate increased in August 2019 to 5.3% from a revised July 2019 figure, according to the ABS. The trend monthly underemployment rate remained steady at 8.5% in August. That's an increase of 0.1 percentage point over the past year. And the trend underutilization rate increased by 0.2 percentage points over the past year. The trend participation rate increased further to 66.2%, while employment continued to grow above the 20-year annual average. So you can see that while some numbers don't look too bad, the fact is that the population growth is moving ahead faster than our ability to employ people. And so the unemployment rate is rising. In fact, they reported a 37,400 gain in total employment. And employment remains robust, with a three-monthly average of 24,000 up in August, 25,900 in July, and 31,200 back in June. In the year to August, employment grew around 310,000 or 2.5%, and the pace of employment growth has eased back from 2.8% over the year in May, but is still stronger than the 2.2% over the year at the end of 2018. With strong growth in working age population at 1.7% over the year and rising participation, employment just has not been strong enough to prevent rising unemployment. And the participation rate hit that record of 66.2%, with the unemployment rate drifting up to 5.3% from 5.2%. Underemployment is also moving higher, with 8.56 from 8.42 in July in season-adjusted terms, and is now back to par with May 2019, which was the recent high employment accelerating as population growth picked up. The softness in the labour market is being highlighted by rising unemployment rather than softer employment. We are seeing the shift away from full-time to part-time jobs, which is reflecting a demand for more flexibility from employers and the rise of the gig economy. New South Wales employment grew 126,000 or 3.1% over the year, compared to the 117,000 or 3.6% year growth in Victoria. Unemployment grew modestly in Queensland at 33,000 or 1.3% over the year. Well, it was a little better in South Australia at 15,000 or 1.8% over the year, and 18,000 or 1.4% in Western Australia. Both unemployment and underemployment is rising, highlighting increasing slack in the economy. Of course, the RBA cut rates, hoping to stimulate growth and lower unemployment, but so far with little success. In fact, we think the unemployment rate will continue to rise from here, with a 5.6% on the cards for the next year, with a profound impact on households and mortgage stress. And so across to the US. The Fed cut rates by a quarter percentage point today in what was regarded as an all but certain move.
Colleagues at the Federal Reserve and I are dedicated to serving the American people. We do this by steadfastly pursuing the goals Congress has given us, maximum employment and stable prices. We are committed to making the best decisions we can based on facts and objective analysis. Today, we decided to lower interest rates. As I will explain shortly, we took this step to help keep the U.S. economy strong in the face of some notable developments and to provide insurance against ongoing risks. The U.S. economy has continued to perform well. We are into the 11th year of this economic expansion, and the baseline outlook remains favorable. The economy grew at a 2.5% pace in the first half of the year. Household spending, supported by a strong job market, rising incomes, and solid consumer confidence, has been the key driver of growth. In contrast, business investment and exports have weakened amid falling manufacturing output. The main reasons appear to be slower growth abroad and trade policy developments, two sources of uncertainty that we've been monitoring all year.
The Fed Chair Jerome Powell said after the decision, "We don't see a recession. We're not expecting a recession, but we are making monetary policy more accommodative," saying it would be a mistake to hold on to your firepower until the downturn has gathered momentum. This was seen by the market as hawkish, much to Trump's annoyance, and the US dollar was stronger after the announcement, and by the way, that's put pressure on the Aussie dollar. They said the labour market remains strong, and that economic activity had been rising at a moderate rate. Job gains have been solid on average in recent months, and the unemployment rate has remained low. Although household spending has been rising at a strong pace, business fixed investment and exports have weakened. On a 12-month basis, overall inflation and inflation for items other than food and energy are running below 2%, so below their target. And market-based measures of inflation compensation remained low. Survey-based measures of longer-term inflation expectations, though, are little changed. In fact, the committee was split on whether to cut and by how much. And the forward indicators show a prospect of yet lower rates ahead, but not as low as some were expecting. And Powell also played down the recent ructions in the repo, the overnight repurchase markets, where banks true off their positions at the end of the day. The Fed was required to intervene again, and actually we expect more ahead. The question is, how serious is this really? Because if today's second consecutive repo was supposed to calm the stress in the secure lending market and ease the funding shortfall in the interbank market, it appears to have failed. As the Wall Street Journal said on Tuesday, for the first time in more than a decade, the Federal Reserve injected cash into money markets on Tuesday to pull down interest rates and said it would do so again on Wednesday and probably Thursday too, after technical factors led to a sudden shortfall in cash. The pressures relate to the shortages of funds that banks face, resulting from an increase in federal borrowing and the central bank's decision to shrink the size of its securities holdings in recent years. It reduced these holdings by not buying new ones when they matured, effectively taking money out of the financial system. And Bloomberg said that while the spike wasn't evidence of any sort of imminent financial crisis, it highlighted how the Fed was losing control over short-term lending, which of course is one of its key tools for implementing monetary policy. It also indicated Wall Street is struggling to absorb record sales of Treasury debt to fund a swelling US budget deficit, and what's more, many dealers have curtailed trading because of safeguards implemented after the 2008 crisis, making these markets more prone to volatility. And Bloomberg today said that there were signals that more interventions would be required ahead. The Federal Reserve made it crystal clear that it doesn't want US money market rates to spike again like they did earlier this week, and it announced that it will, for the third day in a row, inject cash into this vital corner of finance. And on Thursday, the New York Fed will offer up to $75 billion in so-called overnight repurchase agreement operations, adding another dose of temporary liquidity to try and restore order in the banking system. And it, of course, made the same offer on Tuesday and Wednesday, deploying a tool it hasn't used in a decade. This latest action follows the Fed's reduction in the interest rates on excess reserves, or the IOER, which is another attempt to quell money market stresses. The prior operations had calmed markets, with repo rates declining during Wednesday to more normal levels after jumping to 10% on Tuesday, four times where it was last week. In addition, as Credit Suisse pointed out, the Basel capital rules have changed. The longer-term issue is that the definition of excess reserves has changed in a Basel III environment. Previously, excess reserves were defined by the Fed's standard. If banks held more in the Federal Reserve accounts than they needed to settle transactions with one another, they had excess reserves. But now, under Basel III, excess reserves are defined by a global standard. And banks not only need enough reserves to settle accounts with each other at the end of each day, but they also need to hold enough reserves for liquidity and capital buffer purposes. Indeed, reserves are better high-quality liquid assets, the HQLA, than even US treasuries. And in this context, at the beginning of 2017, when Basel III really kicked in, banks found themselves with excess reserves by Fed standards, but deficient reserves by Basel III standards. And making matters worse for a little while were the Fed's balance sheet reduction efforts draining reserves from the system. And this could be a signal of a potential liquidity crisis, perhaps even echoing that of 2007. Now, all of these issues relating to repos are, of course, quite complicated. But standing back, I think this does indeed suggest that the Fed is having some difficulty in controlling rates at the short end of the yield curve. And bearing in mind the inversion that currently exists, this could have quite significant ramifications for liquidity down the track. So we'll be watching the trends here very closely. It's certainly too early to call it a crisis. But nevertheless, we begin to wonder whether in fact the Fed is fully in control, and indeed if liquidity does become a problem, whether that's another leading indicator that we saw back in 2007, and we all know what happened then. And so if we stand back even further and think about some of the data points that we've touched on, there seem to be some eerie resonances back to the pre-GFC environment. I guess only time will tell, but just remember that the crashes happened in September and October, and we should therefore be on notice. Could history be repeating? Or if not repeating, maybe rhyming. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.